This episode is brought to you by Interactive Brokers. And Interactive Brokers has key competitive advantages for sophisticated investors like you. IBKR's margin rates are from just 5.83 to 6.83%, and IBKR was rated lowest margin fees by stockbrokers.com. With IBKR, you gain unparalleled access to over 150 global markets across stocks and options, futures, currencies, bonds, and funds, all from a single unified platform. IBKR has low commissions with no added spreads, ticket charges, platform fees, or account minimums. Plus, IB's award-winning trading platforms for mobile, web, and desktop are loaded with powerful tools to help you succeed. The best-informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Get started today at ibkr.com/compare. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Kicking off the mega cap earnings, rate cut bets, well, they fizzle. Yields, on the other hand, keep rising. The VIX hovering around 16. And our guest today is John Williams from Shadow Stats. All this and much more on episode number 866 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. It's Financial Literacy Month. It's April. That's every time, every year. April is it. It's Financial Literacy Month, and that means you're in the right place. Getting to know more about finances. Learn, educate yourselves, getting insights right here on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Doing it since way back in 2007 when people said, what's a podcast? That was the first thing I said when I was approached about doing it. And I'm like, what does that even mean? I don't understand. I'm the host, Andrew Horowitz. Been here for all these years. I'm always studying, learning. It's an ongoing process of understanding the changes, the differentials, the advancements, the innovations in what is going on in the world of investing. And it's not enough anymore just to learn the basics. Econ 101 that we learned in whether it was whatever school is great, but didn't really teach us a lot about finance. When I say about finance, I'm not talking about balancing a checkbook. I'm talking about investing for our futures. Back in the day when it was as easy as balancing a checkbook because we had both Social Security and retirement plans from our companies, we didn't have to worry about all these things. Put some money into some stocks and just let them sit, do its thing. You know, bought IBM, we bought Disney, we bought whatever it was back in the day, you know, U.S. Steel and Burlington Southern, whatever the names were, and just let them do their things or just put it in a broad-based mutual fund and be done with some of our excess money, even in a high-yield money market. Today, things are so much different. And the reason is that we have been, unfortunately to a degree, forced to take care of ourselves. Yes, there is still Social Security, hopefully at least for some time in the future. When it comes to our retirement, which is really what we're doing, right? We're saving money now for the future. We're doing what we can. We're sacrificing our good time vacations, foodie treats, luxury items, gifts, cars, boats, because we want to have some money for the future. Now, hopefully, our health is going to hold, knock wood on that. We hope that things will work out as planned, but they don't always do that. The planning on paper doesn't always become the result that we see in real life, IRL. The fact is that what happens is something in between. There's roadblocks, the things that come up. All of a sudden, we need a roof. We need a new air conditioner. There's a health issue that pops up. All these things are part and parcel to the process. However, the difference that we have today from the days of just simply understanding how to balance a checkbook and understand the basics of economics is that we are fully responsible for our future. And that's why it's so important for you to understand what is going on in the world of investing. What it means when interest rates are moving up or inflation is moving down or what is happening. And you know what? Like I said, it's always changing, never ending. There is always a new something happening. Over the last 10 years, think about all the different things that have happened. We've had innovations in crypto, for example. We've had free stock trading that's hit in the last number of years. No commission stock fees, ETFs that really took over from mutual funds. I remember a couple of years ago, we had SPACs and we had factor investing. ESG was big for a while. Even mobile trading and research. And we can go on and on with the list of what has actually been new just over the last decade or so. Can you imagine what we're going to see in the next decade? So the question during Financial Literacy Month, April, every single year, that I'm going to ask you this month of 2024 is, how are you going to keep on top of all those changes? How are you going to keep abreast of understanding, besides just, of course, trying to get it all from me, because I can't give it all to you? It's kind of a rhetorical question, is that we're really, it's not possible to keep on top of it all, not even if it's your full-time job. But here is something I think will be real helpful to keep you in the game. And maybe understanding of what is happening out there and keep you on the right path. That's the bottom line. As long as you don't stray too far. It's a simple little tip, little tidbit that I'm going to give you today. Something I want you to take at heart. I want you to think about. I want you to do your homework, take it back with you, sit on it, try it on. It's not earth-shattering. It's simple. It's basically this. Keep an open mind. Keep an open mind. No preconceived notions about a stock, an investment, a sector, a type of investing. I mean, I'm being serious here, because we all have some. We can't do anything about it. It's natural. It's just part and parcel of who we are. But what I've learned over the years, I got to tell you something. What I have learned over the years is that you need to check those at the door. You need to put those aside. As hard as it is, I know it's difficult, because we're like, well, I'm stuck in this. We take sides. We stick with them. We can't get off of it. It's our beliefs. Somehow we believe our beliefs. You know, we have this thing. Who says? I say, well, that's it. No, I don't know. Fact is that you can say something else if you want to, but you don't want to because you're stuck in your ways. That happens in investing. But you know what? Who is that helping? I mean, let's break this down for a second here. Let's say that you hate Facebook like me, right? And you won't invest in the company. It's up 450% since the start of 2023 or so. I don't know. Maybe you don't like burnt coffee. You won't invest in Starbucks. Or maybe you love weak coffee and you invest in Dunkin'. I mean, you get it, right? These are decisions made on inputs that may not be fully logical. And all I'm saying is there's this way that we are. We're preconditioned. And we all have these ideas that hold us back in this area. Because we have a very special place in our hearts for our money. Don't you? And just like everybody else, most of us don't like to lose it. And while in fact we are willing to risk, and while in fact willing to invest in a way that seems logical, sometimes our, not even our emotions, but our thought process and our assumptions get in the way of what we do. And then the amplification factory in our brain makes it even more difficult. The decisions that we make are out of emotion and fear being the number one. So don't do that. Which is, of course, easier said than done, right? I mean, let's not say, oh, okay, all right, thanks, Andrew. I'm going to do it that way. It's a lot more difficult. The question is, we have to train ourselves to do things that maybe are right for us, even though they don't feel like they're right. We know they are right because they are proven to be so for this reason or the other, but it doesn't feel right. So you need to let it go. And the question is how. So here's what I want you to do. And I was thinking about this. What could we do to get you starting on the road to recovery to get rid of those preconditions? It's just try it on in a small way. One time. Something small. So let's say, let's get a scenario going. Let's say, let's pick on one that is an all-time, you know, the love-hate relationship. Banks, the mega banks. You hate your bank. You hate, I don't know who you work with. Wells Fargo, Bank of America, whoever it is, right? KeyBank, whatever. You hate them. They charge you $3 a month for low, for fees or overdraft fees for this or, you know, checking and you can't get to anybody. Nobody speaks English. I don't know. Whatever your issues are with the banks out there. Let's look at some of the banks. And you stay away from, and by the way, and then what happens is you stay away from the entire sector, which may be right at times, but it may be wrong also at times. Well, let's look at some of them like a Bank of America, a JP Morgan from a valuation standpoint and see if that holds up. And maybe what you can do, crazy as it seems, it's kind of a intervention discussion here. I want you to buy one or two shares. That's it. Seriously. One or two. Like, what could it hurt, right? One or two shares. If it has an opportunity. If you look at the financials and maybe look at the analyst research and look at what the charts say and say, you know, that does look like it could be something that I invest in. But then you're like, well, I'm not investing that because I hate the banks. No, I want you to invest in it anyway and see how that feels. It may seem silly, but I'm telling you it will work because it will get easier. You'll be like, okay, I'm going to let this go for a while. If you still have to have rules like everything else, right? If it drops down, I'm going to take my stop and take my money out. And if it goes up, I'm going to possibly take some profits or add on, whatever happens, right? But it will get easier because once you get your foot in there, and I've talked about this before, right? One foot in, one foot out, getting you back to investing. I can't tell you how many people have taken us up on that offer to help them dollar cost average into the market, even though they were afraid and scared. And by golly, it's been pretty good for them. And I want you to spend a few moments thinking about what areas of the markets that you can't stand. What areas that you think are just, oh, I couldn't invest in Ford because they're gas-guzzling cars and I only want to be in EVs and Tesla. I don't know. Whatever your story is that you've made up in your head and you look around and you say, wow, look at that guy. He's got that stock. It's done so well. Or I'm not investing in NVIDIA. It's too high. Again, preconditions, assumptions, things that you put into your head that are now going to help you because we're going to change your behavior. It is going to get easier. It is a little weird buying just one or two. But having those on your statements to see what's going on that you own that, I'm telling you, and especially if you do your homework right and you pick a decent one and you invest wisely, you're going to be really proud of yourself. Seriously, I'm not kidding. You'll be really proud of yourself. You'll be like, ah, I overcame that. That's been haunting me for, you'll admit it to yourself. Ah, I have the same situation. I get it. By the way, I don't like Facebook. Stayed away from it. I don't like Starbucks. Stayed away from it. Other reasons too, by the way. It's only a couple out there. But I've gone in and I said, you know what though? Those are silly things that I need to change up on. Looking at buying things on the dip, you know, when you think it could be going lower, but you realize, you know what, how much lower is it really going to go? And let's start getting a position in there. Or buying on the breakout, you're like, well, it's kind of high, but you know what? This does have a trajectory and this does have opportunity. Getting away from all those preconceived notions about what is and what isn't that you've made because you said, and that is your belief. Something to think about. I want to talk about some economics for a moment here before I get to our guest. I want to talk about a piece that we wrote for our clients this week, and it was about the manufacturing and the ISM composite, which we put together from the ISM services and the ISM 9 manufacturing. Before I do that, I'll just mention all the information about what we talk about on the show, how we invest, what we do, over on the Disciplined Investor .com. So you can scoot over there to see the show notes on episode number 866 or the past guests that we've had as well on the shows. All that information on how to find that information about us, them, some of the items that we talk about all over there. Also how to subscribe to the podcasts and yeah, all that. But we wrote this piece for our clients this week. This is a summary of that. We talked about the ISM and basically inflationary pressures are, we know this, are exerting this big drag on both manufacturing and service sectors, right? And what it's doing is it's slowing their pace of growth. And the reason for this is the rising costs of production inputs, such as raw materials, right? Energy, labor. And these cost increases are squeezing profit margins from businesses across all sorts of industries, prompting them to really look internally and reassess their production strategies, right? And their operational efficiencies. That's what's going on. So our ISM composite research, which is a blend of manufacturing services, 30% of manufacturing, 70% services, showing it's not growing or showing a significant level of expansion. Now, while it's still above 50, sorry, I don't know where 60 came from. I'm thinking 60. Came with 50. That's good thing because we're still in expansion. So there's nothing like flashing a major warning just yet, but we're really just hovering right above it. Any month where we see a slowdown that could happen could dip us down below 50. Now, is 49 like, oh my God, run for the hills? No. But what we're seeing is the impact of inflation and what is happening long-term down the road. But and it's really important to recognize that in response to higher costs, which is the inflation, that businesses will, you know, have tough decisions to make. Some of them will pass them on, you know, these higher costs to consumers through the higher prices. But that risks slowing down consumer demand. And others may absorb the cost temporarily. We've seen that in a few companies and many companies. And, you know, they want to remain competitive for a while. And that impacts their profitability. And potentially it causes a problem for the investments and the expansion of the company, innovation. Now, in the service sector in particular, it's very labor intensive. And these industries, like, for example, healthcare, hospitality, you could really feel the higher costs hit hard because the higher labor costs coupled with rising expenses is a problem. And it makes businesses adjust their service fees or maybe even the quality of their offerings. So that's a problem. And that strains, puts a strain on consumer spending because that's a problem. So amidst all these issues and challenges, we have an environment of uncertainty. And what we're going to probably see as this goes on and as inflation stays higher for longer, that long-term investing decisions may be delayed or scaled back. And companies, I mean, they're going to be a little bit more cautious. They want to make sure that in the face of persistent inflation, that they have a good, you know, good lead on things. So in essence, the slowdown in manufacturing and services sector due to this persistent inflation is going to really test management. And those that can survive this are companies that you really want to pay attention to because companies will get meaner and leaner. And both there's a macro and a microeconomic level that all has to be dealt with. So with that in mind, this latest inflation data that we're seeing, generally speaking, just the broad swath of it, some of it better, some of it worse, is becoming a little bit more concerning, though, generally, because we're seeing it as being sticky. The sticky nature of higher prices that probably going to bring a bit more of an economic slowdown next year than people think. Something to keep an eye on. No question about that. With that, we're going to get to our guest, but I want to talk about something that's really important because if you haven't downloaded this yet and checked it out, I really encourage you to do so. Because I want you to discover the future of trading with IBKR Desktop, Interactive Brokers' next generation trading platform. Built from the ground up, IBKR Desktop combines powerful features with a unique set of groundbreaking tools in a streamlined, intuitive interface. And whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, IBKR Desktop redefines what you can expect from a trading platform. You could be doing it from here, US, overseas. It's available in all places around the world. Experience the future of trading today. Download IBKR Desktop at ibkr.com/desktop. Our guest today is John Williams. He's the founder and publisher of ShadowStats.com, and he received a BA, AB in economics, cum laude, from Dartmouth. Also an MBA from Dartmouth's Amos Tuck School of Business Administration, where he was named the Edward Tuck Scholar, which is amazing. Great. He's had a long career in the area of economics. He's worked with individuals as well as Fortune 500 companies. And he's been doing this for decades. He's given 1,000 presentations on U.S. economic outlook. And I'm very glad to have him because he's a very wise fellow, and I appreciate it. John, welcome aboard today.
Thank you very much for having me, sir.
You know, last time you were on, it was January 2023. And we were talking back then about economic manipulation, just things generally, you know, that were going on and how when governments don't like what they see, sometimes what they do is they change the methodology, right? That's happened.
That's correct.
And economics, as that sometimes is referred to, is sometimes called the dismal science. And, you know, there's also a lot of reasons. That was a term coined by Scottish essayist. I think his name was Thomas Carlyle. He described the discipline of economics and said to be inspired by gloomy predictions that populated would always grow faster. The population would always grow faster than food and dooming mankind to unending poverty and hardship. I want to talk all about that, but I want to go back for a second because I want to set the stage because I don't think we've ever done that, you and I. Let's start with, okay, how did you get into this whole business of, let's call it, economics? Then somewhere along the line, you said, you know what? I'm going to try to publish the real stuff that I believe is true rather than just follow what they're telling us.
Well, it actually goes back to when I got out of school, and I had studied econometric modeling and worked on developing econometric models for some Fortune 500 companies that would predict what was happening. One lot of problems with the econometric models is that things are coincident, and if your numbers are coincident, it's tough to predict into the future. So I always like to work with good lead times, and I was doing pretty well, and noticed that the government was beginning to shift its some of its key numbers. The first big change was a consumer price index, and that happened back in 19. It came out of 1980 when there was a big jump in the headline CPI, which is the Congress looked at it, realized it meant there's going to be a big upward adjustment to Social Security in the next fiscal year, with the effect that they couldn't spend as much deficit money as they wanted otherwise. And what the Congress did was call in the Bureau of Labor Statistics to see what could be done. Newt Gingrich was heading the Congressional Committee, and Laura Abraham was the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And
I thought that was the Bureau of Liars and Sinners. That's what it's labor statistics, huh?
It is. That is what they say. They go, they're abbreviating, but your liars and sinners is probably closer, is much closer to the mark. But this was something that was effectively forced upon them, although there was not much of an objection. You can find a way to calculate the CPI this way. We can probably find more money for the Bureau of Labor Statistics. That was the message. And they changed. And the first thing they hit, the big thing they hit, and it's key to many things, is the consumer price index, very specifically cost of living adjustments. And what they did instead of where they started with the housing numbers, housing costs, and instead of measuring the actual cost of owning a house, which is the way it had been, they revamped it to a category called homeowner's equivalent rent. The government would estimate what a homeowner would rent his house to himself for, and then how much he would increase that rent on himself each year. And the initial impact on that was on the headline consumer price index, it was it knocked a 1.5 percentage point off the headline year-to-year inflation, which is
That's
rather significant.
Mm-hmm.
And but that wasn't the end of it. It just went on and on and on, and it's been ongoing up to date. There's nothing nothing illegal about changing the way you calculate the numbers, except it's far removed from anything like generally accepted accounting principles, which the private sector has to abide by, because you're not using the same concept. You're changing the concept to change your numbers. That's where generally accepted accounting principles otherwise come in business, because if you could shift those what you're accounting around the same way the government did, you could work all sorts of frauds. And this is an outright fraud in terms of the numbers. But I developed some good econometric models on the economy and on inflation. All of a sudden, they stopped working because the underlying statistics were being monkeyed around with. So I thought I would at least go after the changes that were made there. And what I started doing was restating the government's consumer price index the way it had been calculated before. And I didn't just, use my numbers on that. What I did was I used the government's numbers, because whatever they change, they're at least straightforward enough to admit it. They lay it out. Here's what we did, and they'll give you an estimate as to how much the change will affect the in this case the consumer price index. So as they went along and made a number of changes over the years, what I did was I just re-engineered the CPI index to put back in what they took out using their estimates of the effect. And every single change here, and this is back going back over, I guess we're up to 40 years now, every single change had the effect of reducing the headline inflation. None of them upped the headline inflation. And,
but for what point? For what rationale? Was it so that cost of living adjustments won't move? Was it because?
Yes, it was to reduce headline cost of living adjustments and to reduce Social Security payments, which was getting to be too big of a portion of the budget and creating deficit issues.
It was nothing to do with the optics of it and what it looked like for people, so they weren't concerned, even though they know they paid more money. For example, on your website, shadowstats.com, you have the CPI inflation. I'm just going to read what it says there. It says the CPI chart on the homepage reflects our estimate of inflation for today if it was calculated the same way it was in 1990. The CPI on the alternative data tabs here reflects the CPI as if it was calculated using the methodology placed in 1980. And if you look at the two, just look at the official, which is the CPIU, right? And you look at the shadow stats alternative, which is a 1990 based, which I'm looking at. I'm not looking at the 1980 based. I'm looking at the 1990 based. It's bad enough to look at this one, okay? Right? So you could see that really the difference is substantial. And I encourage everybody to go over to shadowstats.com and check this out. But what's interesting is technically there has never been a deflationary moment going back to 2000. I'll go back to 2000 on this chart, as opposed to three or four different clips throughout time, 2009, 2010, of course, 2020. But none of those things were necessarily... it's the difference is stark, and this
well,
is
it is again after 1980. It's before 1980. That's the way it was, and you did have periods of deflation, but they with the way the economy evolved and the way the government spending evolved, that has not been. Much of an issue in recent decades. If you add all the changes that they made in methodology since that, it was really 1982 was when they instituted the change. The aggregate is about 8 percentage points. So that had they not made the changes that they did and keep making new changes aimed at reducing the inflation, headline inflation year over year would be about, they effectively report it the way it, they would like it to be.
I get that.
The way it was reported, had they not made the cuts, artificial cuts, you'd see the inflation 8 percentage points higher, basically.
Over that time, but right now you're showing you're showing inflation somewhere in the neighborhood about, oh, I'm going to round number the 7.8% versus which we'd be right now. We probably clipped out about 14% during that inflation spike recently. The official number is, let's call it 3.8, 3.9, whatever, somewhere around there. That's still a significant differential right now. The gap has always been about that much on an annual basis different, but that's pretty substantial, I think, in terms of our ability to understand what's actually happening. And in fact, there was a recent, I think when we had you on last time, there was a recent change once again to the methodology underlying the CPI number, wasn't there?
There have been up, well, let me put it this way. What I do, I take the government's estimate as to what they have done and its impact, and I use their estimate of its impact. I don't make my own assessment on the impact. I use their numbers. So that differential is based on what the government has reported they've done. What they have, where they've had some changes recently, they have yet to publish the impact. But again, all the impact has been towards their wanting to understate. And so it has been understated. And the headline inflation is even higher than I'm reporting. Where they've done things recently, where that was all tied to the pandemic, and that they will publish a paper on that. But when the pandemic hit, and you started to have a sharp inflation, which was due to the Federal Reserve's pumping money supply, they shifted to balancing that out with a three-year moving average on the CPI.
Mm-hmm.
So what was happening today was happening today, but that was smoothed some by what had been the lower inflation of the prior 2 years. Then when the shifted, you got beyond the worst of the pandemic and the inflation started coming down, they shifted it to a two-year moving average. So it's everything they've done has always been aimed at giving you as low an inflation number as they can possibly give you, and it's not consistently reported.
It's almost like a breach of contract. You know, you buy a TIPS bond, and you're supposed to be going by the official inflation, but they change the rules. That's kind of a bit of a breach of their. You know, if I did that, that would be, if I was to, you know, give people false performance information, I'd be in big trouble.
Yes.
But they're the government. Absolutely. And they're here to help.
So they're here to get reelected.
Yes, they are. So this is real. I mean, let's talk about then, let's flip over. I got a few other things to go through and then I want to tie it together. Let's flip over to unemployment. The unemployment numbers, you also use an alternative. You have a few different alternatives, of course, but the May 2023 shadow stats alternative unemployment increased to, people need to sit down for a moment and listen to this number, 24.7%. And the U6, you say the broadest measures went from 6.7 to 6.6, but the official number is sub 3, right? Or right about 3.8%, I think, is the number for unemployment, right?
Yeah, that's what you're saying on the site.
What am I missing here? How is this so different? What is you counting that they don't count? What is
government has several measures of unemployment. The headline they call U3,
mm-hmm.
and that's that counts the number of people who are employed as measured by actually having worked in the last, actually being actively employed against those who were unemployed and officially, and they add the two together. That's your labor force and the unemployment rates of unemployment divided by the labor force. Mm-hmm. And they call that U3. That's unemployment rate 3. They have a broader measure called U6, and it's the same concept, except the labor force and the unemployed are extended by 6 months. If you're a discouraged worker, that is, you've been looking for work and you can't find work, they'll count you as looking for work. Mm-hmm. And with that, you get up around 6% or so. And the problem is they only count you if you're unemployed for 6 months or so. If you're not looking for work because there are no jobs to be had in the last 6 months. Mm-hmm. There are people in areas where there are just no jobs to be had right now. But after 6 months, they're no longer counted in the U6 measure. So I've looked at it, and I just look at it very broadly in terms of people who want a job, they want to work, but they've given up looking for work because there are no jobs to be had, mm-hmm. period, where they are, without putting an artificial 6 month time limit on. And if you do that, you find that the headline unemployment, the broader unemployment, people who want to work, but there are just no jobs available, you get up over 20%. And that's...
John, that contradicts severely the tight labor market theory. What are they just... I mean, I hate to really put you on the wall on this, but are they just making up stuff as they go and saying what they want to say? Because, I mean, if these are even close to reality, you have to wonder, what are they telling us?
Well, their numbers are based on hard surveys. The thing is that there are areas of the country and industries that are suffering and have been suffering, where there's been a lot of jobs lost, and if the people can't find a job and there's not a job available for them, they've stopped looking for it. If jobs became available, they'd be out there looking again. What it means is that there are pockets of unemployment that are pretty severe, and the government's not really recognizing them because it's not looking at the severe unemployment or the severe lack of jobs on a relative basis in certain areas.
But are you taking into consideration right now the change over the last, let's call it 10 years, in the people with the gig economy that are actually working kind of in an underground manner versus in official capacity as an employee, as a statutory W-2 employee? Is that being figured in? Because the reason why I can see the inflation numbers, but this chart that I'm looking at is just so, the differential is so incredible. It seems almost hard to believe.
Well, I don't have access to people who are completely off the books or say they're unemployed. I mean, you could pay if people are unemployed, but they're really working. That's a different story. Or if they're, excuse me.
No, again, if they're making money, but they're saying they're unemployed.
Yeah. That will be there. I have no way of measuring that, but I can. I'm looking at the people in terms of the what the government reports. I use their numbers. they'd like to work, but they want to work, but there are no jobs to be had. That's their response. And the thing is, if they haven't looked for work in the last 6 months, up to 6 months, the government will count them in its broader U6 measure. But if they've given up looking for work beyond that, when that 6 months is artificial.
Yeah.
The government counts them through the 6 months, and then if they're not looking after 6 months, they just drop out of existence in the government's numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. These people are still there, and it might be 8 months, and they're still not, there's still no jobs available, and they're still not looking. But if the jobs become available, they come back into the workforce. Wait until the economy picks up. I think you'll see a very sharp jump in the employment, but it's going to be a long time before the economy picks up here. We've got major issues ahead and major inflation ahead, all of which have exaggerated roots in the crisis created by the pandemic.
So let's go to that. Last week we saw that a GDP number came out that was a little bit softer than anticipated. However, inside of that GDP report was another marker that showed us that inflation is not done. You know, let me take you back to something. Last year, at the end of the year, and my listeners know I've said this 1,000 times, so they know this already. They're probably bored with it. But the idea that we would have 7 rate cuts going into this year and that the Fed went along with it was a great faux pas, in my opinion. The idea of keeping steady with a steady hand with their squashing of inflation rather than an early victory was stupid. And what happened was the expectation then ran into, you know, if interest rates are going to come down because the Fed is going to cut, why not buy a house? Who cares what I'm paying for an interest rate? I'll just refinance one day, which, you know, that's a risk people can take if they want. But the truth is that adds to the inflationary pressures. The fact that people said, you know what, I could take out some loans and refinance. I could spend more money. I'm not worried because, you know what, just around the corner, everything's going to be, you know, peaches and roses and just, you know, fairy dust and all this wonderful stuff because the Fed is going to reduce down rates to a level, you know, maybe not zero, but pretty low. Then we got into 3 rate cuts. Then we got into no rate cuts. We got maybe a rate hike. We see the numbers now that are coming out from the GDP number and inside of there where the price is paid and all that on top of the PPI, on top of the recent CPI, all those things. And we some little reports here and there were better than expected, but I think you're really concerned about a trend that you're seeing with regard to the combination of GDP trends and inflation, right?
Yep, and the Fed's right at the center of both of those. In terms of the inflation, it's not just the Fed. You have to thank the federal government and its extraordinary deficit spending. But let's look at the Fed here and the pandemic, because that sort of laid out the groundwork for where we are. And the Fed was in an extraordinary circumstance. As the pandemic hit, the economy it collapsed. And they started flooding the system with liquidity. Mm-hmm. In fact, in the month of March, when the as the pandemic hit, they pumped the equivalent of 30 years worth of annual monetary stimulus into the system to keep it from collapsing. That also is creating inflation. And as the inflation picked up, the Fed was saying, "Oh my goodness, we have an overheating economy, and that overheating economy is is driving the inflation. So we've got to raise interest rates to slow down the economy and slow down inflation. That was nonsense. Mm-hmm. There never was an overheating economy in the pandemic period. They very simply wanted to pump up the money supply, and at the same time to raise interest rates.
Want to raise interest? Oh, they just want to get out of the zero bounds. Is that what you're saying?
They want to get down out of the zero bounds because it's the banks can. The banks have had some problems there with margins and such. As the Fed was making the shift. But as you get the interest rates higher, the banks can, and they stabilize their policies, they can, they'll be making more money and they'll be more stable. Liquidity that was pumped into the system was aimed also at helping the banks. That was a money supply, but it's a money supply. It's a money supply that was driving the inflation, still is driving the inflation. If you look at the money supply as it existed before the pandemic hit, and then the Fed, this extraordinary stimulus and flooding of liquidity into the system. You know what else they did? They redefined the money supply.
Mm-hmm.
You used to have M1 and M2, and you still have M1 and M2, but where M2 is the aggregate money supply as they report it, and M1 is the narrower, the more liquid measures. They redefined the M1 so that you couldn't look at it in terms of a consistent historical basis before and after and do econometric modeling with it. The only areas that you could do that with, and I addressed that, is what I now call basic M1, which exists both before and after February, March of 2020, which is currency, cash currency, and demand deposits or checking accounts. Now that exists both before and after. And what you'll see is that there's been a tremendous flight to liquidity. I call those two measures basic M1.
Mm-hmm.
And back before the redefinition, before the pandemic, they were 20. They were bumped up very sharply.
Mm-hmm.
Just the currency and the currency and the checking accounts. That's where people spend their money. That's the money that they spend.
Right, that's the liquid access that are accessible through, what do they call them? It used to be savings, passports, checking, and all that, right? The stuff that's touchable.
That's right.
Yeah, the stuff they that's like instantly accessible. ATMs, for that matter.
Yeah, they don't liquidate their treasury bonds or bills, right, to go out and buy groceries.
Right.
So that it was that narrow measure of M1 that is, it's the most liquid. I'm calling it basic M1. And that's what's driving the inflation. That's what people are spending.
Because that's where money was deposited directly from stimulus.
Yes, absolutely.
So that's the money that's easily attainable. People don't go, hey, maybe I'll buy something from my IRA accounts. Like, let me have the money from my checking account, my ATM, Zelle, et cetera. That's how they spend credit cards. And then they pay off their credit cards with their M1.
Yep. And that's the... So if you look at liquidity, and then it's liquidity that drives the inflation, right now it's at a 57-year high, and I measure liquidity as a ratio of that basic M1, the cash and the checking accounts, that's the fully liquid, as a percent of the total money supply M2. And at the coming into the pandemic, that liquidity was at 21.4%, or at least that was the ratio of the of the basic M1 to M2. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, it was a percentage of the total the total money supply. Oh, M2, yes, okay. And that right now, that's 35%. That's again a 50%, 57 year high, and that's that is that's driving the inflation.
But the point you're making here is something very different than is being proposed by the mainstream Fed officials, which is disinflation, which is a thing that they brought on to make everybody feel better, to make it seem like it's deflation, to make it seem like the prices are actually going down, when in fact it had nothing to do with that. It was just prices weren't going up as much. And they pushed that word disinflation. Everybody got excited about it back, you know, that things are going to change and we're going to get rid of this inflation, when in fact it's just slower amount of increase in the already extraordinarily high price of eggs. And then on top of that, we still have a significant amount of money sitting in M1, M2, and that's not really decreasing. But the point you're making is all this is leading to the fact that you believe that inflation is going to pick up steam once again, right?
Well, I'll contend that it already has. I mean, yes, it depends a little bit how you define the inflation, but yes, it's and any way you look at it, it's going to get a lot higher.
So with what happens?
We have a hyperinflationary risk ahead of us.
Well, we had that for a moment. We had that for a moment, and it was sucky, right? Everybody was freaking out, but we bought stuff anyway. But the second round was where I do also believe that it could be people are going to be much more discriminating of what they actually spend on, because they have to at this point, right? Back then, it didn't matter. But what does that mean? Let's take that to its next point. You have a hyperinflation. You have lower overall growth. Here in the U.S. we're talking about. What does that mean to you?
Worst of all times for consumers and investors. It's going to be increasingly painful. High inflation's generally tends to be more painful than low inflation to the average consumer. Here we have a circumstance where it's going to be accompanied by weaker economic growth as well. So it's really the worst of both worlds. Mm-hmm. And it's an after effect of the way the pandemic was addressed. We have not only do we have the Federal Reserve pumping up the money supply in ways that, again, if you look at the basic M1, the liquid, it's holding around it's up 120% from where it was before the pandemic. Again, 30 years worth of growth in just a couple of months here, and that's the driver of inflation there. But the other part of the driver of inflation is the federal deficit and the deficit spending, where the Fed stimulated inflation with its pumping up of the money supply. The federal government has pumped up inflation by stimulating the deficit spending,
right?
Taking on really unfettered debt growth and spending it, getting it out into the system, rather than keeping the deficit under control. And between those two factors, you have strong inflationary pressures that are still ahead, pushing it higher, and that is. It's out of control. Mm-hmm. With both of them.
Now, is there anything that you remember from the past that was anything like this? I mean, we didn't have any pandemics in the past. We had wartime environments, but I don't know if we stimulated as much. Was there anything that you could think of, not only maybe here in the U.S., but around the world, that is anything like what we saw that is, I mean, I look at my economic charts and you have to like look at it and take out mentally 2020, right? That time period, because nothing made sense then. But for what you see coming up in the future, is there an analog? Is there some kind of model that you're thinking of which it would be like?
Well, it's to the extent you've seen unfettered creation of liquidity and money, which is what we're seeing here. The end result usually has been high inflation, if not hyperinflation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I look. I'm afraid of the risk of the hyperinflation here. And in that type of the circumstance, we've had high inflation, but we haven't had hyperinflation.
And how do you define that? 20%?
No, hyperinflation is it gets to a point that it's the old money is just worthless. It's used as toilet paper.
Oh,
as it was in Germany.
Uh-huh.
I've had a fair amount of dealings with some German companies and know people who lived through the very difficult times in economic times in Germany at the end of the 20s into the early 30s. And they had a hyperinflation. And that's similar to what I think we could see here. And one story the export manager told me was he remembered one night when his father had traded his shirt for a can of sardines for the family dinner.
Mm.
And he brought the sardines home. He opened up the can of sardines. The sardines had gone bad, which I guess had something of a lesson in it. But the currency effectively became worthless. And you devolved to a barter system. And even with the barter system, some of the things you bartered didn't.
Maybe a can of sardines.
What was expected.
Yeah.
It was a very difficult time. Then you have a reform and all sorts of things. The one thing that has held its value over time in the inflation environment are the precious metals, particularly gold, both gold and silver. And so I urge people to hold some physical gold and silver, preferably in something identifiable as coins, so that you don't have trouble bartering with them. If it's a gold ingot, somebody's going to want to assay that. If you're trading it for something, nothing wrong with it. But it's the coins tend to be they tend to get recognized for their own value that they're. No, that's an established amount of gold or silver.
Hmm. Your house, you're bumming me out, man.
Well, your house is well, real estate. That also has a real value. It's inflation hedge, but it's not portable like gold and silver, and it doesn't move as quickly.
No, clearly not. Clearly not. Especially,
you've been seeing some boom recently in the precious metals. There's a reason for that.
Yeah, there is.
And I think that's because people are beginning to sense there's an inflation problem here.
Hmm.
I would caution that it's just beginning.
Yeah. John Williams, always a pleasure having you on. A little bit of a dreary outcome from this conversation, but I encourage everybody to go over to shadowstats.com. Check out all that's available there. There's a lot of really interesting and rich data that you will really... I think have a moment to think about this kind of makes some sense.
No. Hold on a minute here.
Oh,
reason you had a little trouble finding things on the website, and the website collapsed back in August. What you see there is the website as it existed in August, and it's got 20 years of archives, and it shows you the different things that I do. But for the latest numbers, you need to send me an email, and I can set you up. What I've done is I've shifted over to providing subscribers with emails that have the latest commentary as well as the latest graphs and alternate data. And I'll be pleased to send a sample to anyone. Happy always to talk and give people the background here. The website shows you what's there. I'm rebuilding the website, but it's not there yet.
What's the email address?
If you're a subscriber, you receive a regular email with a text that was always updated on the site and with the latest numbers and alternate data files and graphs.
I'm a subscriber. I get that. I appreciate that, by the way. I enjoy it. So how do they get that subscription?
Send me an email at johnwilliams@shadowstats.com.
johnwilliams@shadowstats.com.
Right.
Perfect. Well, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show, and always enjoy talking with you. You know what you're talking about, and I always find your comments very interesting.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. You be well, and I'll talk to you soon. Thanks. And that's going to wrap it up with this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I mean, we're going to have inflation. We're going to have hyperinflation. I don't know. Sounds kind of spooky, but I do encourage you to check out what's going on over on shadowstats.com and send them an email, get that subscription. You'll get it in your mailbox. And you'll see what's going on. Next few weeks, pretty exciting. We've got Frank Curzio coming up a couple of weeks. Tia Muratvek is coming up as well. We got Kim Flynn. We got Michael Johnston, Jim Rogers, Jim Bruce. There's a lot of great names coming up. Jared Dillon. All this on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me this week and every week. And I'll see you again real soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.